This is Too Political, the podcast in which two old friends talk about politics, the news, and whatever else we think of. My name's Arthur.
And this is Jason.
And together we're
Too Political.
Hi again, and welcome to Too Political, episode 11.
11. Oh, sorry.
I don't have a song for 11. I'm afraid they only go up to 10 on, what the heck was that? Sesame Street.
Sesame Street. I'm disappointed.
Ooh. Oh, well. Okay. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. We're having a wonderful summer.
It must be nice.
It's mild and non-humid. It's very counterintuitive in Washington, D.C. not to be, you know, walk to the subway and feel like you've just been, that you need to be in the spin cycle at the in your washing machine. And Harry Potter opened today, largest midnight receipts ever, $22 million. So. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try and go see it this weekend.
We had an earthquake.
I heard Hawaii had a tsunami alert.
So did parts of Australia, Lord Howe Island. The authorities told people to move a kilometer inland and go to high ground. Of course, there was no tsunami. But Hawaii is where the Pacific's, warning center is.
Right.
And they routinely issue tsunami alerts when there's a earthquake of a certain size, and this was, of course, big enough. And they were worried that it might lead to a tsunami, which, of course, it didn't. But
and did you feel it?
No. It's over 1,000 kilometers away at the bottom of the South Island. Apparently, they heard it. There was at least some ability to feel it as far north as Wellington, which is, at the bottom of the North Island.
That's a long ways.
Yeah. We're talking about minor, like, oh, was that an earthquake kind of thing, I think.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. Obviously the further away you get, the less you feel it. The area where it hit has hardly anybody in it. It's an area of the country called Fiordland. And so there was no damage reported.
I'm going to take a wild guess here. Fiordland, I bet it has fjords.
Indeed it
Am
does.
Am I right?
It does.
Wow.
But yeah, so there were no deaths, no injuries, very minor damage, like things falling off store shelves, stuff like that. And certainly wasn't a big deal, but it is the biggest that New Zealand has had in 78 years. The last one was in 1931 when Napier was flattened.
Oh, right.
So, yeah, it's a big deal.
We almost went there, didn't we?
Well, it is. Yeah, we thought about it, but it is so far away from Auckland.
Kind of out of the way, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about couple days to get there, probably. Well, maybe not.
Next time.
I've never been to Hawke's Bay. I'd really like to go. The Napier, because it was rebuilt in 1931, that was during the Deco era, and so most of the town is a Deco town. The architecture is all Art Deco.
That would be cool to see. Well,
yeah.
The next time I'll save up my $8,000 so I can fly business class.
Good plan.
And come down there, yes. Oh, I think that leads us into special days, don't you? Yes, I think that leads us into special days. Well, my special, two special days, because they're always my special days. Maybe we'll let you have special days one day. This is St. Swithin's Day. Of course, you missed it, but it's July 15th is St. Swithin's Day. And we'll have links. This is it's rather an amusing day, since it sounds like they just kind of made it up because they have no idea who this Saint Swithin was at all. But it's about rain and stuff like that, and it's very English. It's very English. If you read it, it's like really very unbelievably English. And the second one is your favorite this time. It's the Yarmouth Clam Festival, which is July 17th.
I just love that name.
And they're going to take there'll be a link on the show notes about this, talking how they're going to take the oil that the clams are fried in and recycle it and make it into something that can power automobiles, alternative fuels.
It's funny you should say that, because there's actually a small industry doing that here in New Zealand with fish and chip shops. You know, they take the oil that's left over from frying, and then they filter it first, and they turn it into sort of a biodiesel, which is apparently quite clean, quite cheap. But they're actually doing it in other parts of the U.S., I read somewhere.
Yes,
but
yes.
It's becoming difficult to find the stuff, because what used to be a waste product that the takeaway shops had to pay to have hauled away is now a sought-after commodity, and they're actually getting paid for their used oil that used to be a waste product, which is actually kind of a cool thing if you stop to think about it.
Well, it's a very cool thing. Yeah. I mean, that's isn't that the whole idea?
Yeah.
Isn't that the whole, you know, using things over again?
Yeah.
It's if we could, well, the whole notion of, you know, oh, it's so hard to do all this stuff. Well, see, it's all these little dinky things that are going to make the difference. It's not going to be, you know, the one big thing.
Exactly.
So,
but hey, you know, speaking of waste products.
Oh, that was a real, oh, I can see Russia from my house.
Exactly. Did you see the news that Sarah...
I don't know if you heard this. I'm thinking this. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but this, of course, happened when I believe Obama was in Russia, and somebody said, oh, I wonder if Obama can see Palin's house from Russia. Anyway, I couldn't resist that one.
Yes, we are, of course, now talking about the waste of space, Sarah Palin. And I was just wondering, did you see in the news that she's talking about forming a conservative political party now?
Yeah, nothing up my sleeve. well, a couple of really quick things, and we'll go on to real news, which I found she bitched and moaned up a streak about the terrible, awful media. Yet the last Tuesday, which was, you know, when the Michael Jackson service, or Wednesday, whatever day it was, she was literally the second major story on every single network she gave an interview to. She had an opinion piece in the Post on, this is Wednesday, Monday. And it's just like, yeah, well, gee, I think if she does run for president, I want people to be able to, I want lots of people to stand up and raise their hands and say, okay, if things get tough and people say bad names about you, are you going to quit this time?
Oh, trust me, they will.
And they should.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing to come along and say, I'm not going to run for re-election because I might be seeking higher office. I think that's, you know, a lot of times people run for re-election. It's just like, well, you know you're going to run for president. Why are you doing this? It's so that, but at least that's sort of, you know, but this was just ridiculous. So they said bad things about me.
Yeah.
Boo-hoo-hoo, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, I wish her luck on that third party, because third parties in America have always been so extremely successful.
Well, that's the thing that a lot of Americans forget, is that the last third party that actually was successful was the Republican Party, and that was 1860. So we're talking about a long time between drinks, you could say. Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, I mean, I hope she does it, because it would splinter the right, and that would be a good thing. But the other thing is that it might be the salvation for the Republican Party, because then all the whack jobs can leave the Republican Party and go follow her over a cliff. So that could be a really good thing for the Republicans. They might actually have a chance to take their party back from the lunatics.
I don't think there's much left.
Well, there may not be. And that's certainly the way we can find out.
Now.
That's certainly the way we could find out.
Now.
Yeah. But the speaking of lunatic Republicans, they've been going to town over this Sotomayor nomination. I still cannot quite get over how they're like a pit bull with a bone, or whatever, or a cat in its mouth, and they're not making any sense. They know they can't stop the nomination, and I mean, we've talked about this before, obviously, And I think that we were saying that one of the things that they're doing is they know they can't stop the nomination. They're not trying to stop the nomination. They're just trying to play to their base. But in doing they're alienating everybody else.
Well, they're trying to appease the great leader, Rush Limbaugh. That's my new name for him. He's the great leader.
I like Boss Limbaugh, because it implies he's just an old-time Paul, you know, not a legitimate figure.
I think the thing that is silly... I think it's the silly, you know, the Latina comment, and, you know, and how she sort of retreated that from that. And, oh, I think it was taken out of context. But this whole notion of like, oh, well, you know, you've got to judge things and you've got to go only by the law, only by the law. Well, then the logical conclusion of that would be that all the decisions on the Supreme Court would be 9-0, because... the interpretation of the law would be simply one way.
Yeah.
There was only one way. You're only interpreting the law. Well, you're interpreting the law. And I think it is intellectually dishonest. I understand, you know, why this has been is being done, but it is just completely a lie, a falsehood, whatever, you know, words you want to use, to say that your background does not influence
Absolutely.
Your decisions.
Absolutely.
Now, I think it's a legitimate question to say, now, here's your background. How do you separate, you know, sort of your background from looking at the law, or how does it filter it? And you know, this, I think those are sort of, you know, legitimate questions, but this notion that it can't possibly exist is just bullshit.
Well, even beyond that, this whole question of identity politics assumes that it only works in one way. And Eugene Robinson had an excellent opinion piece on this in the Washington Post. And there's one paragraph in particular that stuck out to me. And he said, and this is a direct quote, "Republicans' outrage, both real and feigned, at Sotomayor's musing about her identity as a wise Latina, how her identity as a wise Latina might affect her judicial decisions, is based on a flawed assumption that whiteness and maleness are not themselves facets of a distinct identity. Being white and male is seen instead as a neutral condition, the natural order of things. Any identity, in quote marks, black, brown, female, gay, whatever, has to be judged against the supposedly objective standard." And that is exactly the crux of the problem. The Republicans are white males primarily, and they tend to see everything as being white male oriented, that this is your starting point, this is the neutral position, and everybody else who's different than that has to justify their existence and their attitudes and their beliefs and all these things because it's not white male. And Eugene goes on to talk about how, you know, we've got our first African-American president, and when she's confirmed, she'll only be the third minority to serve on the Supreme Court. So the power structure in Washington for generations, really, has been white and it's been male.
Yes.
And it's – what's clearly going on is that the Republicans are taking that as the starting point, saying it's always been white and male. It should always be white and male, and anybody else is going to have to try and justify what they're doing.
Yeah. He has another line, which I think is sort of what we've been talking about. And it goes thus it is possible for Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama, to say with a straight face that heritage and experience can have no bearing on a judge's work, as he posited in his opening remarks yesterday, apparently believing that the white male justices he has voted to confirm were somehow devoid of heritage and bereft of experience. I mean, it's how you take your worldview and use it. To say that it doesn't somehow influence you is just ridiculous. And we have a... Okay. I mean, it's silly. It's like, I have had an experience where I have been mugged. I mean, and so I'm going to have a different take on, if I were a judge, on cases probably involving mugging. Would I recuse myself? Ooh, good SAT word there. or not, I don't know. But I'm going to have a different viewpoint than someone who's never run into that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like if you were involved in sort of some sort of a strip mining case and you grew up in the big city, where would be your frame of reference? Where if you grew up like maybe in West Virginia or Montana or Wyoming, you might have a reference to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's how you use that. But this notion that it's devoid and you're going to divorce yourself from who you are, it's just stupid.
Well, it's also impossible.
Right.
We can't ignore who and what we are and our life experiences and so on. And it is stupid, you're right. But it's also part of where the Republican Party's ideology is at the moment, that one of their talking points is that Sotomayor will introduce identity politics to the bench, you know, as if this is a new thing. I mean, hello, Thurgood Marshall was not a white man. Clarence Thomas, for all his other things, is not a white man.
Well, you
Ruth Bader Ginsburg is not a man.
You sort of had for a long, long time. There was sort of the black seat. There was sort of the Jewish seat.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, I mean, I read, you know, I'm not making this stuff up. I read about this, you know, when this came up, and it's just, I don't see what they gain by this. This is to throw, you know, to appease the great leader and his followers, but I really don't see how they get anywhere with this. And I thought I watched Hardball with Chris Massey this last night, and he brought up what I thought was just a very, very funny point. Lindsey Graham, who I usually like, was sort of talking about Sotomayor about having, you know, sort of anger management, and Chris Matthews sort of, well, you know, that she's sort of angry on the bench and, you know, sort of goes out of her way to be sort of, you know, poking at people, so for lack of a better way to describe it, and Chris Matthews was talking about, wasn't Lindsey Graham this great big cheerleader for John McCain, you know, who doesn't have any sort of a temper at all.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, that was, they have to, I think part of it is they have to be relevant. I mean, they haven't been, you know, particularly condescending to her. And then they had all these things that are just, and the Democrats are just as guilty when Republicans are, you know, when like Alito and Roberts were up, you know, like, oh, well, here's a situation. How would you rule?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you know, and someone was talking about, well, you know, I'm a woman and I'm in week 38 and there's, you know, there's something that we found out that the, you know, the baby was going, is, you know, going to be mentally retarded or has spina.
Yeah.
Is it all right to have an abortion? And it's just like, no, you know, it's like asking the president of the United States, okay, Iran launches a nuclear weapon somewhere and or blows somebody up. What are you going to do? You're not going to tell people that.
Well, it's not even just that. I mean, in the case of Alito, they knew damn well he was anti-abortion. He had a strong anti-abortion track record. What they were trying to do is make him admit it publicly. Not that it would have made any difference because the Republicans had the votes. But the thing is, we have to start with the reality that the confirmation hearings are irrelevant. All they are is political theater. It's the chance for both sides to play to their base. And that's all it is. Nothing is ever accomplished in these hearings, apart maybe from the Clarence Thomas hearings where there was the infamous pube in the Coke and all that
and
kind of stuff.
And the Bork hearings. But, God, that was a generation ago.
That's true, too. You know? But since then, there hasn't been anything. I mean, John Roberts got far more Democratic votes than he should have. Alito, everybody knew that he was a hardline, hard right winger before he ever was at his confirmation hearings, and the Democrats were trying to call him out on it. But, you know, one of the things we talked last time about how the conservatives have been attacking her, saying that Sotomayor saying that she would be the most liberal justice ever, and I said, well, what's wrong with that? I mean, she isn't liberal by any stretch of the imagination. But
no,
what's
no.
wrong with having one? And I've been thinking about that since. And one of the things that bothers me about this whole frame that the Republicans have built is that there is something wrong with having a liberal justice, and that's what we were talking about last time. But I thought about it, and I thought, I am a liberal. Why would I think it's ever a good idea to have a conservative on the bench? Now, we talked before about having balance, and the more I think about it, the more I think that balance is illusory, because what we're basically talking about is ideological balance, as if that's going to somehow indicate how they're going to vote in the bench. And Souter actually is an indicator of somebody who can't be predicted based on their supposed ideology.
Right.
So what I would prefer is somebody who is liberal, because I think that they are far more likely to take a wider view of the law than just what the, you know, James Madison and all the others said more than two centuries ago. They're going to look at the law as a living, breathing thing that evolves over time, whereas the hard right people are going to look at entrenching the vested interests that are already there, the power elites continuing their access to power and their privilege, which is primarily white and male in America still. But in a very few short years, there will be no ethnic majority in the United States. It will be a nation of minorities.
Right.
And we've got to move beyond this paradigm of white, male, conservative, good, everybody else questionable at best.
Well, but see, that's there. their way of holding on to power. You know, whether or not the Republicans are able to regain, you know, the presidency and houses of Congress is, of course, debatable. But there is this shift that they have no control over, and their base, I'm sorry, is getting old and is dying off.
Yeah.
You know, when you have young people overwhelmingly, you know, voting for Obama and voting Democratic, once you sort of get those, you know, start that trend, it's very hard to win people back. Now, you can in sort of individual type elections,
yeah,
but the trend usually becomes the trend. I mean, unless, you know, there's like, you know, like the, you know, like the Reagan Democrats and stuff like that, and then there's sort of a realignment. But I don't see where they go with this. I don't see where they go where the faces of the party are Newt Gingrich and yeah, and Rush Limbaugh and, you know, and people like that. So,
well, that's exactly right. I mean, if the, as you say, that the Republican Party base, membership, whatever, is getting older, it's still white, overwhelmingly white, and their leaders are just slightly less old white men.
And very southern.
Well, many of them are, but not all of them. I mean, they're, well, actually, I suppose most of them are, or border, yeah, state at best. But mm-hmm, if you look at these people, their so-called leaders in Congress, they are spouting the most bizarre nonsense half the time. And, I mean, I understand why they're doing it, because they're trying to create political advantage for themselves. And so they have no incentive to tell the truth or to be accurate or whatnot, because they're just trying to score political games. And that's what being a politician is about much of the time anyway. Mm-hmm. But the thing that strikes me is that they seem to be disconnected from the truth. There's a different – you can tell sometimes when politicians are taking – a partisan stand because they think it's going to advance the interests of their party or their legislative agenda or whatever. But in the case of the Republicans, it almost seems like they don't even really know what reality is anymore. I'm talking about the leaders in Congress in particular here.
Right.
And sometimes I look at them and I think, what planet are you on? Because they just don't seem to have any relationship to what's going on in the real world anymore. They keep talking about bipartisanship, the Republicans do, and they keep criticizing the Democrats and President Obama for not being bipartisan. I'm thinking, bipartisanship is a goal, not a necessity.
Right.
And there are times when the Democrats have to say, well, fuck you then, we're just going to go on without you.
Right.
Because the problem I have with this whole notion of bipartisanship is that what you're saying is that the Republicans have a valid viewpoint that must be accommodated. They don't always have a valid viewpoint. And the Democrats will, from probably many times over the next couple of years, have to use their majority to just ignore the Republicans and move ahead and do what the country wants. And I think healthcare is going to be one of those issues.
Yeah, I think that's – they passed a bill in the Senate, and of course there's this big – to do about the public plan and all sorts of stuff like that. What I've always found so fascinating is how the Republicans demonize it. It's going to be a government plan, and they're going to tell you which doctors you can go to.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, it's sort of like the private plan that I have, like people who are in – doctors who are in network and doctors who are out of network. And you can go to a doctor that's out of network, but you have to pay more money for it. So what I would love to say to one of these guys is, okay, you have a problem with a government bureaucrat telling you which doctors you can and cannot see, but you have no problem with a bureaucrat from a private insurance company telling you the exact same thing.
Of course not, because the one with the private company is enriching one of their donors, so that's okay. You actually touched on a point there, though, about the healthcare debate, where the Republicans have been absolutely hammering this point about the public option and saying how this is like evil and it's socialized medicine and all that. And that, of course, is absolute bullshit, because it's one alternative. And
Right. The
president has repeatedly been talking about how it must be included as to give people the freedom of choice to decide what's best for them, which is, you know, hello, it's a Republican value, freedom of choice.
Right.
But the thing is, if you listen
to, so that's a problem.
Sorry?
It's big. I mean, I can understand them saying it's some of them saying, okay, I don't think we don't think government should be in this. This is big government. That's viewpoint I can sort of understand, but that's not the route that they're taking. They're doing the boogeyman of the government.
Well, yeah, and this is actually touching on what I was talking about before about them being detached from reality, because they keep talking about how awful this public option is, and they are clearly implying, they haven't said it in so many words, is that the public plan would be so wonderful, so great, so fantastic that everyone would flock to it and abandon private insurance companies. Well, that's assuming an awful lot. It's assuming that the private insurance companies can't lift their game, that they can't deal with competition, that they're not capable of offering a better service than the government plan could. And I mean, come on, how likely is it that the companies can't shift to meet the market? They do it constantly. There's no reason to think the private company can't do better than a public option if they want to. So the Republicans are shooting themselves in the foot with this thing, because what they're essentially saying is that private business is too incompetent to provide quality health care, and therefore they must be protected from a public option because they're too incompetent.
Right. Well, that's part of it as well. And again, they trotted out this, you know, this ancient old dog of, well, what we'll do is we'll give people a tax credit, and they can use the tax credit and go out and buy health insurance. No, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, you cannot put out money for somewhere down the road to get a refund. You're living paycheck to paycheck. What are you not going to do? What are you not going to pay rent? Are you not going to eat? This whole notion is just so ridiculous. It's like this notion of vouchers. Oh, you know, school vouchers, and we're going to give them so much money, blah, 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 blah. You know, well, the problem is that the money that they would get isn't enough to get them into any sort of a school, private school. It's not enough money.
Yeah.
So it's the same notion of, okay, where are they going to come up with the money?
Yeah.
And which I don't think has been really properly addressed or really looked into sort of by anybody is all the costs that we are now paying anyway for healthcare that we just don't know about.
Oh, yeah, a lot of hidden costs. Like, for example, people don't go for preventive care because they can't afford it, and then it gets really bad and costs a lot of money to fix, if it can be at all. That's just one thing.
Right, or they go in and they never pay the bill.
Yeah, there's all kinds of aspects like that.
You know, and so that's sort of the Chinese water torture of healthcare, which we don't see, and that would hopefully go away. I mean, there's some other sort of legitimate concerns that people have brought up. If you're bringing all these people into, you are now insuring them, which means they are now able to go to doctors. Where are the doctors? You know, like the general practitioner people, which, you know, that is a legitimate thing to say. Okay, you're doing this. Where's the infrastructure to support this? But, you know, it's...
But that's the chicken and the egg thing, because if you can't afford to pay your doctor, then you don't need the doctors. But when you can afford the doctors, then you will. So, I mean, at some point you have to say, right, we're going to do this now, and then we're going to
build up. And it might not be perfect, and it won't be perfect for a couple of years. I mean, it's a huge, massive plan, and that's the way it's going to be. It's like this, again, this stupid notion from the Republicans, like, well, it's been 5 months and the stimulus hasn't worked yet.
Yeah.
Unemployment is still going up. It's just like, let me see. Unemployment is always the lagging indicator in a recession or in a recovery. So, of course, it's going to still be going up. And, you know, they bitched and moaned about, well, they're not putting the money out quickly enough. And they're actually doing exactly looking at this. They're doing exactly what they should have done.
Yeah.
And that is that the numbers for unemployment were going to continue to go up. What their mistake was saying, oh, it won't rise above this level. They shouldn't have said that. But it's, you know, it's probably going to go over 10%, and that's double digit, and you know. But that's something that's going to happen. And so when most of this money starts really kicking in the fall and the beginning of next year, then there will be, I mean, it is going to happen. There's a lot of things that have to come together. And as many people said, the president being among them, that it's, you know, it's not going to be instantaneous. And as a couple economists say, is that this might be like sort of a U recovery, a U-shaped recovery. We're going to sort of bounce along at the bottom for a while. And then there'll be some fits and starts. Well, you know, I mean, were up, the stock market is sort of up, you know, and it's just going to happen that way, I think.
And, of course, these are all going to be issues that are going to be coming up a lot over the next few weeks, particularly healthcare over the next month or so, because President Obama wants them to have their first draft completed by the end of August. So I'm sure there'll be things that we'll get to comment on over that as well. But I was thinking that we might do a short episode today and just kind of wrap up.
It's not summer down there, but it's summer here.
No, it's not even almost summer. But one thing I did want to mention is that we got our first 5-star review on iTunes from Fairy Princess Holly. So thank you, Holly.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, I was just kicking around on iTunes USA the other day because there are things that are on iTunes USA that we don't get. And I was sort of just looking around. I thought, oh, I'll just see if we've gotten any reviews. And sure enough, we had. So thank you very much, Fairy Princess Holly.
Yes, thank you.
People are more than welcome to leave a review on iTunes if you want. Quite frankly, it's not going to affect anything because we're in the news and politics category, and we're never going to be a featured podcast because it's just, I mean, every major news outlet in the world practically is in that category. But
They should really divide it up.
They really should. There should be the,
you know, sort of like professional
stuff.
And then the more, we just.
I think they should do that in all the categories, actually. But who knows how the voodoo at iTunes rankings works? So
that's very true.
But we'll be back in a couple of weeks. And by all means, stop by the website, twopolitical.com. That's the number twopolitical.com to leave a comment on this or any other episode. They're all there for your downloading pleasure or listening pleasure. And, of course, you can ring our comment line on 206-350-3982.
Oh, you have the number. I'm so proud of you.
Well, I brought it up in advance so I wouldn't forget.
Oh, okay. That's very good. Very good for you. That's very good. And it has a sterling, wonderful, incredibly welcoming announcement.
That would mean
and
that
I bet you'll never guess who did it.
Either. That would mean you finally had a chance to record it.
Yes, I did. I told you about it. I sent you an email and said done, and I received absolutely no comment whatsoever from you, but I won't take that personally.
Well, that's good.
I just won't do that. So, and you can reach me, not reach me. You can view what I'm talking about. I haven't been blogging as much as I should have been, but it's kind of summer and I've been out walking around. I'm walking around in the evening in July without losing 25 pounds in sweat, which is really quite amazing. Anyway, it's been a really amazing summer. Anyway, you can find me at jasonsviewfromdc.blogspot.com. And where might we find you, Arthur?
Well, you can find links to all of my stuff, podcasts, videos, blog, everything, at amerinz.com, amerinz.com. See, isn't that simple? I don't have to say all these URLs anymore.
I know. One-stop shopping.
It is.
It is, yeah.
Well, until next time, that's it from Auckland, New Zealand.
And goodbye from Washington, D.C. Bye, everybody.
Bye.